I most significantly met him when I was asked by him through other people. He'd had a stroke in 1981, but he had been asked by the Archbishop of Mogadishu, which happens to be the capital of Somalia, to send somebody to Somalia, which was then bereft of priests because they'd all been thrown out except four of them by the communist dictatorship in 1974. It was now 1981. And the Archbishop thought it would be a bright idea to see, well, if a priest did come in, what would happen to him? So yours truly, it so happened, was the guinea pig in regard to this. But Pedro Rupe had said, this was, as I say, before he got sick, see if Somalia is a place where the Jesuit Refugee Service should be engaged. The refugee service was set up only a year earlier, so it was in its infancy. And the idea behind that was, again, a very Rupe-style thing, that the Jesuits were stuck in the cement, he used to say. His English wasn't always great, but you knew exactly what he meant. That we were stuck in the things we were doing, and we couldn't really see how we could get out of them to do anything else. Whereas the original Jesuit ideal was of people who'd be coming and going, doing different things in different continents, etc. But they wouldn't stay there forever. If they managed to sort something out or get something going, then they'd be free to move along. And so with refugee situations, there are 67 million refugees, I'm told, but with refugee situations breaking out overnight, say in somewhere in Africa, or the situation of the people coming up from Latin America towards the Trump wall and all that kind of thing, people needing help and support, there needed to be people around who would go and at least be in solidarity with them. They might know the language even, and they wouldn't be coming there as aid workers, but they'd be there supporting and acting as advocates on their behalf, etc. Anyway, to come back to where we were, I was asked to go, and I went to Rome. I was waiting on the plane for Mogadishu, which only goes once a week. And somebody in Rome said, well, would you like to meet Father General? He's very ill, but he'd be glad to meet you because he's so enthusiastic about this refugee service.
Were you enthusiastic about going to Somalia as the guinea pig priest?
Well, I didn't know where it was, number one. It would have been the first time that I'd been living on my own in my whole life. I'd never cooked for myself, etc. I was going to be living in a remote city, if you like, called Hargeisa.
And you might be either exported or
yes,
murdered.
There were a number of options. You could be turned back at the border, at the airport. You could be popped into prison. You could be left free to be there, whatever you were thinking of doing. Or you could be killed. Anyway, I went to Rupe, and my situation was explained to him by the interpreter. And he sort of came halfway up from the couch on which he was lying, and he stuck out a skinny hand and waved it at me and said, "Go!" Well, this was the most dramatic missioning that I'd ever come across. And I did go, and things were tough in Somalia in many ways. But they've been tough since. And that single word, "go," was a great support to me in dark times. So that was my most important meeting with him, if you like. But he came to Ireland several times. And so I was rector of Milltown Park, and he came along. And so we managed to chat. And I remember asking him, I said, "In all truth, how are things going?" And he was saying, "On the one hand, everything is terrific." He was an optimist. But he says, "On the other hand, things are not so good." And he said, "One of my favourite songs," he says, "is Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen." And his problem was that he committed himself totally to the implementation of Vatican II. He wasn't following his own agenda, but the church was moving much more slowly and cautiously. And so there were clashes emerging all the time between the energetic Jesuits who were sort of playing full forward and the conservative bishops who were playing it full back kind of thing.
And he really was pushing the Jesuits to go out and get their hands dirty at the margins where people needed them most. Isn't that right?
Yes, he was following the call of the church in its own documents, as in the Synod of 1971 about the church in the world. The bishops were saying, well, what is the church meant to be in the world? And they came out with the notion that preaching the faith or trying to get people to become people of faith must be accompanied by working for justice. Because there's so much injustice in the world that faith that doesn't link in with that or mesh with it is irrelevant. It's spiritualized. It's meaningless. And people will say, good night, you're the same as Marx who would say pie in the sky when you die. You've got to be saying we need to work to transform the structures of the world. We may die in the attempt. Pedro knew what that was like. He himself had been imprisoned by the Japanese when he volunteered to go to Japan, and during the war, when the attack on Pearl Harbor had occurred, he was then imprisoned because he was thought to be an American spy. So 36 days in solitary confinement and then days of intense negotiation without a break and all the rest of it. And he was ready for the kind of death that you get in that film called Silence, where people are hung upside down over a cesspool and you slit their throats so that they won't...
Their foreheads.
So that the blood won't all go to their head and they die rather immediately. So you enable the drip business to go on and on and on. And after a while, people can't breathe properly. And so he knew all of that. And so he had to face into that. Well, a number of Jesuits, 40 or 50, died in bloody circumstances over the years since we adopted what he wanted us most to do, the project of working for justice in the world while promoting faith.
Yeah, the numbers spiked enormously, didn't they, of Jesuits who were dying, like El Salvador
would be the principal one. So when a few people had been killed in El Salvador, the authorities said, we're going to kill the rest as well. And Arupe checked with all the guys, and they all said, we're staying firm. And he told the authorities that you may kill them all, but we should be there. That's what we're meant to be about. And for us just to walk off would be betraying the gospel, which is a very dramatic and strong way of putting it. And he himself would have been prepared to go there and be killed if necessary.
Because when he was in Japan, they eventually let him out after the war, didn't they? And he wasn't executed, obviously. But he had worked with the victims of the bomb that fell in Hiroshima.
Yes,
that right?
He was, after coming out from prison, he became novice director, training young Jesuits. And then they woke up on the 6th of August to this ginormous sound. And they found that when they were living a tiny bit out from Hiroshima, they saw the whole place was in flames. What had happened was the bomb had fallen, but nobody knew then what an atom bomb was, nor did they know the consequences. And a very simple thing was that the houses of the people of Hiroshima were made basically of wood and partly paper and that sort of thing. They were all having breakfast. It was around about 8:15 in the morning. And so the flames that emerged from the bomb swept right across the city, burnt the houses down and calcified many people. He and his novices, they knelt down and said, what are we going to do? And that's actually a typical Ignatian phrase. You know, when Ignatius was faced by any particular strange or dramatic occurrence or difficult challenge, he'd say, well, what does God want me to do in that situation? And he might have worked out, God doesn't want me to do anything or to stay just as I am, or God wants me to get involved. And that line of thinking of Ignatius goes through Arupe, and he decides to get involved. And then later in the year 2019, Arturo Sosa, our general, is saying, what ought we do? What is God asking us to do? So it's tremendous dynamism and a driving force for us, you know.
He was a medical student, so he went with the novices and they attended to the sick. It must have been horrific to have to witness what he witnessed.
Yes, a lot of these people had been boiled alive. their skin was missing and many of them died. He brought 150 of them into the Jesuit house. So you imagine a house half this size, and he squeezes in all the people that he can take, including children whose parents had been blown to smithereens and who didn't know, the parents, if they were alive, didn't know if their kids had died and all the rest of it. So yes, he used his desk as an operating theatre. The small amount of medicine that he had, he used it, and he saved the lives of a number of people. It was symbolic in a way, rather than sort of totally sorting out the problem. He later went into the city, and with the authorities, he helped to gather corpses, and they burned them then because disease was spreading all over the city. So that scarred him for life, and he saw what humankind can do, and that we need to work in the opposite direction. How do you change the hearts of people so that we'll have no more war, we'll have no more atom bombs, we'll have no more napalm bombing in Vietnam, nothing like that. You know, so what can we do? Well, we're a small group at the moment. Like when he came on, there were 36,000 men. Well, they have dwindled down to 16,000. But if we're there, we're meant to be open to engagement with what the real needs of the world are.